Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 12th of July. What would or would not happen if lawmakers failed to meet the August 2nd deadline to raise the nation's legal limit on borrowing? Why are Republicans and Democrats still so at odds, and there are now daily meetings when it comes to breaking the impasse? Is there a possibility of breaking the impasse? We're going to talk about it the first hour. The president had a news conference, as you'll recall, that preempted our second hour yesterday, so we listened to what he had to say. And we'll listen this hour to Professor Terry Zivney. Professor Zivney is the distinguished professor of finance at the Miller College of Business at Ball State University. He has interests in all aspects of managerial finance and investments, has published in the Journal of Finance, the Journal of Financial and Quantitative Analysis, the Journal of Financial Research, and the list goes on. And he co-authored a paper on an episode where there was a bit of a default. It was titled "The Day the United States Defaulted on Treasury Bills." This was in the spring of 1979, so we'll look a little bit at history during the course of the hour. As always, we welcome your phone calls. They're coming in before we even start talking, so I know you have thoughts on the issue. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Zivney, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me to be on.
Our pleasure. So what would or would not happen if we don't meet the August 2nd deadline to raise the nation's legal limit on borrowing?
Well, the administration says they'd have trouble writing checks, and that's kind of the essence of the deadline. On that deadline, which is basically an estimate of when the amount of cash in the checking account will reach zero, and normally when it would reach zero, the government would borrow more money, but with the debt ceiling being reached, they would not be entitled under the law to borrow any more money. And so a new law would need to be passed to authorize the government to borrow more money so they could pay their bills. So in a nutshell, that's what the deadline's about.
So if they couldn't write checks, what checks wouldn't they write?
Well, that's part of the debate. I think looking at the question is the... there's clearly, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars of checks the government writes every day for all kinds of purposes. And historically, going back many years, as the debt ceiling has neared, Congress and the administrations have wrangled back and forth of all political persuasions, basically using this as an opportunity to get some changes made under the law. It's kind of a hostage type of situation, you might say. And so I think that's indeed part of what's going on now. Historically, this has always been resolved. In many times, what's happened is Congress has passed a temporary increase for a few months. This happened often in the 90s and even in the last decade while they hammered out their differences. But the president is adamant that he will not agree to a temporary increase to get us past August 2nd. He wants to do everything all at once. So that's kind of where it sits right now.
You have written about this case in the spring of 1979 that offers an idea of some of the problems and costs that would happen if the stalemate should go on. Can you talk about that? What about the day the United States defaulted on Treasury bills?
Yes, in spring of 1979, one of these periodic debt ceiling being raised was being debated, and in the process of this procedure going on, the government on three consecutive weeks was late paying interest and principal on Treasury bills. The Treasury Department characterized these as technical glitches that due to processing problems, they did not get these paid on time. According to the law dictionaries, a default is the failure to pay interest and principal on a debt when it's due, and so the government did indeed default on about $120 million worth of debt on those occasions. Sometime later, they made good on that debt, what we would call curing the default, but nonetheless, they defaulted. And Professor Marcus over at UW-Milwaukee and I did this paper, and we looked and estimated the cost to the government of this default, and we estimated that this relatively small default of, as I said again, I believe it was $122 million, resulted in a 0.6% increase in interest rate the government had to pay on their debt. At that time, it was around $8 trillion, a lot less than we're talking now.
Right.
But nonetheless, 0.6% of $1 trillion is $6 billion a year. So, you know, $122 million default caused like a $6 billion a year increase in costs, and one would imagine it would be much larger today.
Yeah, $122 million seems a bit like peanuts today, doesn't it?
Well, some of us, it still seems like a good sum of money, but
yes,
clearly in governmental terms, that's extremely small. And I think it underscores the seriousness of the issue. As I've discussed this with other people, I point out it's a little bit like if you are late on your credit card, you know, you forget to put the stamp on your Visa card payment, and it comes back about 3 or 4 weeks later in the mail wanting postage, and you promptly pay the Visa card. Nonetheless, your interest rate will probably go from about 7.9% as a preferred borrower to the penalty rate of 28% and stay there for quite a long time until Visa is quite convinced that you're going to be a good credit again in the future.
Mm-hmm. You have said, you were quoted in a Washington Post article saying that this 1979 case offers a useful case study in real-world consequences that result when the U.S. government doesn't seem like the sure bet it's always been. And you say it creates doubt, and I think that's the real lesson. Talk more about that. What's the doubt that's created?
Well, the matter of fact that you ask me who's going to get their bills paid first worries investors. In all the scenarios that we've seen, I mean, there's still talk about, yes, indeed, the administration and Congress and everybody else considers the investors, you know, the most important, making sure their bills are paid first. But, of course, you have the Social Security recipients and our military men and women and the federal workers and, you know, people going back to school with the Pell Grants and all these, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars of things paid. Who's going to get paid and who's not? This uncertainty creates anxiety and is going to make everybody that's involved with the government rethink their relationship. In terms of investors, that means they're going to want a higher rate of return. In case of employees, they're going to perhaps be asking for greater salaries going forward because of the increased risk. I mean, traditionally, people looked at the trade-off of working in a government job as well as safe and secure, and so I'll take a little bit less money because I'm going to be here for a long time. Well, if this is not safe and secure, like in private industry, you might want to be paid more money. So this uncertainty creates great costs in the whole process.
And who would make the decisions as to who gets paid? Would that be a congressional decision?
My understanding is that would be the Treasury Department, because they pay the bills, unless there's a new law passed. And, of course, that would have to have the president's signature to have any new laws passed. So, basically, the bills come due, and the Secretary of the Treasury is sitting there with his checkbook, his pen poised to write out millions of checks every month.
You mentioned the fact that the debt limit has been raised many times before. Can you remember a time in recent history, or past history for that matter, when the debate has been so contentious?
No, I don't believe it's been quite this contentious, but it's been used many times as leverage. That's the reason why they've gone through many of these temporary increases, because the deadline would come up and the two sides would be still wrangling about what was going to happen, so they'd have to extend it. And I might point out that when I say two sides, I'm not necessarily referring to what we might think of as partisan Democrat-Republican wrangling. In 1979, as you might recall, the House and the Congress were heavily Democratic after Watergate, and, of course, Jimmy Carter was a Democrat, and there was still this wrangling going on. So, I mean, there's always people to want to use a looming deadline as providing additional leverage for whatever it is they want to get done.
And it, back in that time, was it essentially over the same issue, whether or not we increase revenues, raise taxes, or just cut spending?
To be honest, I couldn't. I don't remember exactly what the wrangling was about then.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any faith at all that this is going to be resolved by August 2nd, that we're just seeing a big show here so that politicians can let their constituents know that I'm really on your side?
Well, I'm sure a very large part of it is posturing, and I'd like to say I have confidence that it'll be resolved, but I have less confidence now than in previous years that these sort of things will be resolved, because I believe that the method of doing things has changed a great deal. In all the previous standoffs that have been had, there's been, you know, give and take on both sides, as opposed to the current situation where it seems to be an all or nothing crammed down on each side. And that makes it much harder to gracefully come to a compromise that makes it look as though you didn't capitulate and lose the support of the people that you're playing for.
Right. The president has said that we have about 10 days here. Would you agree with that, 10 days?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, that obviously depends how things are done in Washington. But as an example, and to illustrate, you know, some of the problems that can come out of this, okay, just remember back to last December when Congress and the president were going back and forth about various budget issues that resulted in those of us who itemized our deductions for income tax were unable to file our taxes on January 1st. We had to wait about 6 weeks because Congress did not authorize until the end of December the particular tax law changes that the IRS needed to implement and prepare their forms and getting up on their websites and getting out to tax preparers. Okay. So even though the law was passed before January 1st, it took time to get all the clerical things done. Okay. And which, you know, probably is what happened in 1979 and what might happen here. I think that's why they're saying that you know, we can't wait until the day of the deadline to pass the law, because it's going to take some time to get all these payments made.
Can you see any way to deal with this issue that doesn't involve both cutting spending and increasing revenue?
Well, the rhetoric really is determining a lot of what's going on. The budget is a big concern, obviously, for everybody concerned. The debt ceiling is really a consequence of all the previous 200-odd years of budgets that's been accumulated. And one of the good things about America is that, unlike many or most other countries, when there's a regime change, the new leader repudiates the debts of his predecessor. In our country, we have a history of always making good on our debts, which is why we have such good credit, no matter how distasteful we might find the debts that were run up. And I think that, you know, Congress is, for the most part, willing to say, okay, we're willing to pay for the $14 trillion we already got. We didn't like some of the things that were spent on. Different people didn't like different things. But the fact of the matter is we'll pay that $14 trillion. We don't want to pay another umpteen $1 trillion going down the road. And so the fact that there's this unwillingness on the part of some people to separate the issue about making good on the debts we already have from the ongoing and continuing issue of getting a budget passed for this year and following years is what's really causing the problem.
We welcome phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Our guest this hour is Professor Terry Zivney. He's Distinguished Professor of Finance, Miller College of Business at Ball State University. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our lines are filled right now, but you can try our email, if you have access to a computer, or just wait and you ought to be able to get through eventually. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, British historian Ben Shepherd, author of The Long Road Home, The Aftermath of the Second World War. It's a fascinating book, and he says the legacies of that time, the State of Israel, the transformation of U.S. immigration policy, the ending of the Anglo-Saxon societies that were pretty much homogenous, Britain, Canada, and Australia, and the creation of a new framework of international law are all legacies of this time. Beyond that, the post-war refugee crisis rehearsed many issues which still confront us today. Ben Shepherd with us, hour two. To your phone calls, Linda in Monroe is our first caller. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Professor Zidney.
Hello.
Now, I think the way to solve the debt problem fairly is to raise the individual income tax based on ability to pay, like President Franklin Roosevelt did, to pay for the debt the war created. Now, he didn't go after Social Security. Now, President Clinton, to reduce the debt, raised the tax bracket up to 39.6%, which none of the Republicans voted for, and the Republicans stated that it would ruin the economy, which it didn't because it got better. And President Clinton also didn't go after the Social Security. So my question is, if President Obama says Social Security isn't the problem, why is it on the table? Because these people really aren't rich. Why don't they go after the 2% that have half the wealth that can easily afford it, and it is based on ability to pay?
Well, those are good questions. First of all, we've heard it said many times that even if you took 100% of the income of the top 2%, that it wouldn't cover the large deficit they're running up. And I think that's, a large part of the problem is that in the last few years, the amount of spending has just mushroomed. I don't have exact numbers in front of me, but rough numbers I'm looking at show that, this fiscal year, the federal government's looking to take in about $2.6 trillion, and they're looking to spend $3.7 trillion. And you're right, most of that's not for Social Security. I think part of the problem is that there've been these very large increases in programs, governmental programs that cost a large amount of money, and the question is how to fund them. And I think that those are legitimate questions. I don't have an answer as to why they do it. Except, again, I would point out that, when you look at that $2.6 trillion of revenue, that includes the money that is being paid in this year by workers like you and me that are paying our FICA taxes, and that money, of course, to a great extent, goes right back out grandma and grandpa that are on Social Security right now, that's basically a self-sustaining enterprise and continues to be for a number of years. That is not a problem. On the other hand, the problem of the money coming in all into the same checking account and now needing to be spent out is part of the problem in terms of the perception that there's this gap. In other words, when programs are passed or new legislation is added, let's add this feature, let's add that feature, a lot of times the funding cost is not put on at that time, which has not happened in the last 3 or 4 years. There was no real concern given about how all these programs are going to be paid for. And so that jeopardizes the programs that are fully paid for, like Social Security, because their money is part of that same pool of money that needs to be paid out beginning in August.
The president said that he was willing to entertain the possibility of Medicare not being eligible for that until you're a little bit older, and also entertain the possibility of changing Social Security in some way. And the Democratic response was, don't touch those, though we're going to run on those issues in the next election. These are crucial to people. Do you think that those massive programs need to be examined and cut?
Well, you've hit on one of my pet peeves here, and that's the word entitlement. When the government used the word entitlement, they mean entitled because they wrote a law. I think of entitled on a more founder's basis, you know, because there's some moral obligation, some moral responsibility to get things. And so I look at the big three entitlement programs, okay, that the politicians like to lump together and say we've got to solve this one entitlement problem as really being three different types of entitlement. You have Social Security. The entitlement there is the moral entitlement that you worked for, you paid into it. In fact, you fully paid into it, and it's fully funded because you paid into it. That's to my mind, is a high moral entitlement. Secondly, you have Medicare. Medicare you pay for while you're working in terms of what is known as the hospital insurance. Okay, that's the 1.45% Medicare tax that the employee and the employer each pay on wage income. Okay, that basically fully funds Part A of Medicare. So it's basically fully funded. It is, therefore, morally entitled because you paid for it. On the other hand, the Part B, that doctor coverage, and the Part D, okay, are not really paid for by the Medicare recipient. They're paid for out of general tax revenues, okay? And therefore, I would say they were earned. In other words, the only way you qualify for Medicare Part B in general is to have worked in our system, okay, for a number of years and have had paid and contributed to our economy for a number of years. So you're morally entitled to it because you have partially paid for it, but I don't view that personally as high of moral entitlement as fully having paid for it as is with Social Security. Medicaid, the third major entitlement program, is one where, by definition, you did not earn it, okay, and you did not pay for it. Okay? And this is entitlement only in the sense that Congress passed a law saying that you meet these particular requirements and therefore you will receive it. In terms of the situation where somebody would say, hey, I paid for it, I expect to get it, okay, Medicaid recipients didn't do that. And I don't mean to diminish their wants or needs. I'm just saying that in terms of entitlement, it's a different nature than an entitlement for which you paid and you have a reasonable expectation of receiving a return on your investment like Social Security. So I think this is part of the problem when they're all lumped together, okay, which is very handy to do because everybody wants to say, I'm just like you, you're just like me, we want to all be treated the same. Well, things are different. Not all of us are 7 feet tall so we can play in the NBA or fleet of foot so we can, you know, play in the NFL or whatever. I mean, we're all different, and that's life.
But do we have to look at the amount of money that we're spending on those programs in order to pay our debt?
Well, again, that's what I was saying. In terms of the Social Security, okay, there has been enough money paid into it over the years, okay, and continually paid into it to continue to fully pay all the current Social Security recipients and those coming of age here very rapidly. Okay, so that should not be a problem. As a side issue, let me basically back off again. On the Social Security tax, the part of the FICA that you pay that goes into Social Security as opposed to Medicare, there's actually two parts of that. One part is for the old age survivors, what we think about when you get to be 65 or 66 or 67, whenever you retire. And then there's the disability insurance, okay? And the disability insurance portion of Social Security, okay? Although, again, you pay into that and you've earned it and you have a moral claim on that. Nonetheless, it has not been charging enough premium. In the last couple, 3 years, there's been a huge increase in number of people retiring very early under disability. Some people say it's related to the downturn in the economy and being harder to find a job and therefore being more likely to be go on disability. But regardless of the cause, the premiums that have been charged for the disability portion of Social Security are probably too low.
Yeah, Linda, thanks for the call. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, I have a question there for the professor. Seems to me that we're going about this in the wrong way, in the sense that it's like a vicious circle. The economy is moving sluggishly, and therefore the government has decreased income, revenues, and so the deficit gets larger. And wouldn't a way around this be to, let's say, increase taxes across the board, but then give the taxpayer a credit for investments made in whatever investment they make that creates jobs? Therefore, you get people employed, you get the economy moving, and you know, if you get up to 4 or 5% GDP growth, then the deficit then becomes not a problem.
Well, that's a good question. Many times in years past, the government has had incentive programs, investment tax credits. They've fallen out of favor in recent years, but they've often been imposed temporarily, these investment tax credits. I think when economists have investigated, they often are dubious about how many really new jobs are created versus people that just took advantage of the credit for jobs they're going to create otherwise. And I think that's a issue that Congress often looks at pretty carefully when they consider these kinds of programs. But indeed, the second part of the question is, would the economy grow fast? If the economy were growing faster, would the tax revenues rise enough to cover these additional expenditures? And again, the economy would have to go extremely rapidly to do this. I think that is part of the concern, is that with the rate of growth we've had in the economy, even in the last, before the recent recession, there was not nearly fast enough growth to cover the giant growth of public expenditures, and that's kind of the real problem.
Well, is there any way to get the economy moving so that maybe we wouldn't tackle all of our problems, but we'd be able to increase our revenue somewhat significantly? That's another big question here. How do we get jobs? How do we get people paying taxes more?
Well, I don't have the answer to that. That's outside of my field of expertise. But again, you know, one of the basic policy questions one might ask is, how much do you want the government to do? Whatever the government do, somebody's going to have to pay for it. And the question is, how much are you willing to pay for it? And I think that's, kind of the genesis, if you will, of the Tea Party movement, is there's many people saying, hey, I'm already paying enough taxes, and I don't want to pay more taxes. And then I think that, for example, yesterday when I heard, President Obama, part of his news conference, he's talking about that he's willing, as a wealthy individual, to pay more taxes, and in Warren Buffett's, as a wealthy individual, is willing to pay more taxes. And I was saying, I hear you guys saying that. On the other hand, every year you have the opportunity on your income tax form to make a voluntary contribution to reduce the federal debt. And to the best of my knowledge, neither of these individuals who are claiming to raise the taxes have taken advantage of making a sizable contribution to reduce the federal deficit. So, talk is cheap, as they say.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, hi. In the Bible, in Leviticus, it says that when you reap the harvest of your land, don't reap the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest, leave them for the poor and the alien. And I mention that because I worked in the prison system, and when we had dealt with a burglar who was convicted or an armed robber who was convicted, they did their time and they were held accountable in terms of the prison system. But and here we have a situation where, in terms of the polls, what they say the will of the people is, they don't want the rich to get the excessive tax breaks which come out of the general funds for all of us, and they don't want the needless wars to continue. But until the voters hold people accountable in both parties for their behavior, it just seems that we're not going to have any solution to the problem.
Well, obviously, different voters have different thoughts on what are what they want held accountable for. I mean, that's why we have two parties, at least in Congress. But I sympathize with your concern. The observation I would make is that the rich people, and I certainly wish I were one, but the rich people are paying taxes. Not like they're not paying taxes. In fact, a majority of the households in the United States of America pay no federal income tax whatsoever, okay? So you have a situation where, the people that are paying taxes, for example, if I were in a 40% tax bracket and I am taking advantage of legal deductions. We had a previous caller wanted to have a deduction for creating jobs. Well, that's reduced, might viewed by some people as a tax break. But nonetheless, the only way you get a tax break is if you're paying taxes to start with. And, you know, again, that goes back to my, you know, view that if you pay taxes, you have some reason to expect to get some kind of service in return for your taxes. And so, you know, it's very easy to say, you know, let's close the loopholes on the rich people's paying taxes. But often those loopholes were created not with the intention of saying, let's just, you know, let Warren Buffett off from paying taxes, but with the idea that those loopholes serve some socially desirable purpose. If we look at our own modest tax returns, for example, we observe we have all kinds of exemptions for things like if you're an elderly person, you know, you get an additional exemption. Okay, that, you know, socially desirable to let them have more of their money to take care of their increased needs with less income coming in. You know, so there are large numbers of deductions that come about because of socially sought goals. And the people that are going to get most of these deductions are going to be the people that are paying the taxes. If you're not paying taxes, it's darn difficult to get a deduction.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Rich and Sullivan, hi.
Hi. I know that part of my college education was paid by a bit of war bonds that my family bought during World War II. And the reason I'm bringing that up is I understand that Grover Norquist's Taxpayers Protection Pledge has been signed by about 234 House members and 41 senators, and that 95% of Capitol Hill Republicans basically are committed to not a dollar more in any sort of taxes, and deductions also are supposed to be protected, at least originally. And the reason I'm bringing up war bonds is I think we Americans are about to learn a valuable lesson that we are in a kind of economic war, and that if we don't want to be taxed, we should have a public policy program that amounts to let's save America by buying what amounts to war bonds under a program that is relabeled something like the Corporation's Responsibility and Americans Reinvestment in America Act, which basically says you don't want to be taxed, okay, then buy these bonds that are linked to the idea that we must bring back industries and high-paying jobs to our shores, because we're in a situation where revenues are falling. People are earning money at $10 an hour, which is ridiculous. Can't support a family on that. And We're in a situation where people don't seem to realize that we really are supposed to own America as taxpayers. I mean, in some sense, I am the government, and I don't get the idea of a taxpayer protection pledge that basically tells me you shouldn't have to pay anything in to support America. It's a kind of theology. It's not just a tax policy. It's a sort of creed that I'm supposed to be committing myself to, you know, taxpayer protection pledge.
Professor Zivny.
Well, I've not actually read the pledge, so I can't comment on the specifics of it. But, I mean, this year individuals are paying, you know, well over $1 trillion of individual income tax. And so I don't believe that the pledge is saying we're going to abolish that. What they're saying is let's not increase that. So I think perhaps Rich might have slightly overstated the issue about not paying one penny towards it. I mean, they're paying over $1 trillion towards it. However, I remember war bonds before my time, but I remember when I was a boy, every week in school, they'd have a saving bond drive, and for your dime, you could buy yourself a stamp and put in a book. When you got $18.75 worth of those stamps, you got a $25 savings bond. And, you know, the pledge was, I think the pitch was, take stock in America, buy U.S. savings bonds. And, you know, those days kind of gone past. I haven't seen one of those pitches in many, many, many years. So there certainly is a question as to whether people would invest in that. I mean, yes, it'd be a great idea if people would lend the debt. But, again, people bought savings bonds. In your case, you went to college. I remember cashing one of my bonds in to go to Boy Scout camp one summer. But the point being that, you know, you bought the bonds because you expected you were going to be able to redeem them at some point in time for a certain amount of money. That was the same thing true in World War II with the war bonds. And World War I also had war bonds. I mean, the idea is that you'd be able to redeem them and get your money back, and that gets back to the debt crisis we have right now where there is, you know, some concern in some people's minds if they invest trillions of dollars in United States government debt, whether they will get their money back. And that's kind of what the crisis is in a nutshell, to make sure that we have enough money coming in over the years to pay back these obligations that we've committed ourselves to.
Thanks, Rich, very much for your call. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Terry Zivny, Distinguished Professor of Finance at Miller College of Business, Ball State University. We're looking at the debt ceiling, the ongoing debate, the possibility that there may be, and if so, how would there be, some kind of compromise before the August 2nd deadline, the different philosophies here, and different perspectives on how hard this would hurt America in terms of world standing and in terms of your pocketbook. So, more phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, the author of The Long Road Home, The Aftermath of the Second World War. We continue to talk about the debt ceiling and whether or not it will be raised by August 2nd. We're having politicians talk about this every single day, but on Face the Nation this week, the Treasury Secretary Geithner said that inaction on this, Professor, would be catastrophic for the economy. No responsible leader would say the United States of America, for the first time in history, should not pay its bills, meet its obligations. Senator Jim DeMint, Republican from South Carolina, accusing Geithner of playing chicken little and calling his dire warnings irresponsible. He says there certainly will be disruption, but this is not a deadline we should rush and make a bad deal. Who's right?
They're probably both right. And indeed, that's, you know, part of the problem in reaching some kind of a settlement to the problem here. The Treasury Secretary is correct in the sense that failing to pay the bills would be viewed as a catastrophe by investors around the world. And the senator is probably correct in that you should not rush into large-scale solutions without reading the details. I mean, you know, voting on 2,000-page bills without reading them is probably not a responsible way to run a large enterprise. So, again, that's kind of going back to my point, is that as you know, the politicians have lumped all these various programs together in one large pot, and they want to talk about the whole pot instead of talking about the various pieces of the pie. It's much more difficult to come to a grand meeting of the minds, and the reason they've thrown it in the pot is to make that decision more difficult. That's exactly why they've done it, in my opinion. Instead of saying, okay, here's Social Security, we have enough money coming in. And along that line, I mean, many of your listeners probably have retirement savings like in a 401k, or if you're a state employee, a 403b. And, you know, Social Security, the so-called Social Security Trust Fund is basically like that. You know, there's several trillions of dollars of money has been invested for many years in government securities. They're available. So, for example, when somebody retires on a 401k plan, they have sort of two plans for retirement income. One is they're going to get dividends and interest on their investments in their 401k plan, and if there are not enough dividends and interest, they'll make a withdrawal of the principal. Okay, and that's exactly the same situation with the Social Security Trust Fund, that normally there's enough money coming in, from current taxes to pay the current Social Security recipients and add into the savings going to the future. And the Social Security crisis that people have been talking about for many years was referring to the time where money coming in from Social Security taxes would not meet the current Social Security obligations, and we would have to reach into our savings, which is fortuitously been set away, just like your 401k, to reach that. And so that's one of the situations here. For example, as you probably know, this year, your individual Social Security tax has been cut by 2%, okay? Which means that, in essence, you got a 2% pay raise for this year. Unfortunately, what that means is there's 2% less money going into Washington to cover the Social Security bill. So money would have to be taken out. So, for example, one way that the government has managed in previous crises and indeed in the current crises to push back this deadline, okay, that they're talking about is by reaching into the civil service retirement system. They have legal authorization. There's been laws that were passed to enable them to withhold making contributions and use that money for other purposes. There is no similar legislation allowing them to use Social Security money for other purposes. Okay, but indeed, the Social Security Trust Fund is available to be those bonds to be sold and raise the money to pay the Social Security recipients. And indeed, every time you sell a dollar of Social Security debt, redeem a dollar, there's now another dollar of available for debt coverage. So again, there would be ways that would be available if the administration were willing to say, okay, we'll do a temporary solution, we'll agree to a temporary solution while we hammer out the long-term solution. You know, again, this nuclear standoff between the two sides is, you know, creating a lot of angst and anxiety.
John,
like the nuclear standoff in the 50s caused the school kids a lot of worry when we were kids.
John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I wanted to go back to a statistic that your guest had mentioned earlier that I've heard used by a number of conservatives when they talk about raising taxes, and that was the percentage of Americans that don't pay taxes, income taxes. And I think it's a little misleading, and that's why I was calling back just to give my interpretation of it. When you talk about the percentage of Americans that don't pay taxes, you're misleading people into trying to think that there are freeloaders, and they're not freeloaders. What it is in our income tax system, we have a system that gives a deduction for the cost of living. We all have to pay for heat. We all have to pay for food. We all have to pay for health care. And there's a certain minimum amount that you have to earn to be able to live in a year. And when you say that a certain percentage of people of the American public are not paying income taxes, the reason is because there's a deduction for that. If you want people to pay more income taxes, you need to raise the minimum wage so that they make a wage that generates more income than the cost of their living. A counter statistic to that Michael Moore brings up is that there are 400 families that own more wealth than 150 million Americans. That's half the population of the United States. If what's happening, what you're seeing, is you're seeing a shift of wealth within the United States as people earn less and have to pay out more for fuel to heat their homes and pay out more for health care just to stay alive and pay out more for food, that they don't earn enough to live off of, and that's what that deduction is for. And when you talk about another conservative bend is when they talk about having a flat tax. Well, what they're trying to do is they're trying to shift that burden onto those people and get rid of the deduction for living. But when you bandy about that percentage of Americans who don't pay income tax, please be careful. Don't mislead people. Try and include the fact that we have a deduction for the cost of living.
Professor Zivny.
Well, indeed. As I indicated before, there were many exemptions in our tax code, deductions, exemptions that have social purpose. And indeed, you have standard deductions. Okay? You have personal exemptions, which I mentioned. You have exemptions for the elderly and disabled. I mentioned all those. The fact is, though, that more than half the people don't pay income tax, regardless of what the reason is. Okay? And so the other half are paying the taxes. And, I mean, that's just a fact.
What about his point, which I haven't heard anybody really dispute, that there are 400 families is not very many in this country who make an enormous amount of money and perhaps are not paying their fair share in taxes?
Well, I don't know what their fair share is. I mean, again, if I were one of them, I'd see the difference. But and I don't know how many there are. But let's just take a simple example of saying that there were roughly 400 billionaires. I think there's actually around 1,000 billionaires if you look at the ones that only got like $1 billion. So that's like $1 trillion. If you took 100% of their money, that wouldn't cover the one-year deficit. Okay? You took 100% of their money. You took Oprah's and everybody else's money. You know, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, took all their income. Wouldn't cover the deficit. So I think that is what, you know, John called the conservative position, is that, you know, the spending has got out of control. And just as those people who have modest means say, look, I don't have enough money to cover things, you know, many times, you know, many residents of the United States wish the, you know, federal government, or in some cases their state governments, would say, hey, you know, we really can't afford these luxuries. We'd like it. I'd love to vacation in the Caribbean or whatever, but I can't afford it, and I have to prioritize what I can afford, what I can't afford, and what I can afford is not based on my desires. What I can afford is based on my income, and there is a finite limit to the income. Okay, there is an infinite limit to the things I could look to spend my money on, and we have to make some priorities, and those are tough decisions.
Thank you, John, for your call. Kelly in River Falls. Hi, Kelly.
Good morning. I'm just curious what your guest thinks the odds are that agreement on a debt ceiling will be reached before August 2nd. I think it's 100% that they're going to raise the debt ceiling, because I think, like Timothy Geithner said, that the consequences would be catastrophic. But I'm wondering if your guest could tell us what some of those consequences might be if, in fact, they fail to raise the debt ceiling.
Well, first thing I learned when studying finance is don't make predictions, because and then you don't have to worry about being wrong. So I don't really know what the odds are. I hope Kelly's right, that there is 100% chance that they'll raise the debt ceiling and avoid a default, because I think having a default would be calamitous. In addition to the personal costs, for example, of people not getting, you know, individuals, perhaps, let's just take a simple example. Suppose we say, okay, we can't mail the Social Security checks, so a lot of people don't pay their rent this month, or they don't buy their can of dog food to eat, or whatever it is that they were getting by on. Okay, those are personal tragedies. But in addition to that, you would have, as our research showed, you know, from back in 1979, there'd be long-term financial costs to this event, even if it were solved relatively quickly after the fact, because investors around the world would demand much higher rates of interest. The United States can't stop borrowing. We owe, you know, what is it, you know, $14 trillion. Okay, we have, the way we pay the $14 trillion is we borrow more money to pay the $14 trillion. Okay, so in order to do this, okay, we have to borrow money. And if the investors say, hey, I'm not sure I'm going to be paid in a timely manner, I think I'll go invest somewhere else, the only way you entice them back to loan you the money is to offer to pay them a higher rate of interest. And that higher rate of interest, since we're going to be paying on this $14 trillion for years and years and years and years to come, okay, is going to be paid for years and years and years to come. So this could be a very expensive proposition.
Does that answer everything, Kelly?
That's great. I agree with your guess 100%. I think that borrowing would get real expensive for the U.S., and I think the dollar would plummet if, in fact, this thing comes to pass. But
right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. And let's go to Mark in Richland Center. Hi, Mark.
Your guest just pointed out that in order to pay debt, we have to borrow more money. And that looks to me like a completely mathematically unsound system. If you go to themoneyfix.org and to many other places that study monetary policy, the process of borrowing what we call the currency, and it's only borrowed in the amount of the principal, but it's owed back in the amount of the principal plus the interest. The interest is not in the system anywhere. So the system is always short. So So when you base your entire monetary system, just as the guest explained, that you have to borrow money to get more money, when you base the entire system on debt, the never-ending spiral of further and further debt is absolutely unstoppable. So the process needs to end of using debt as money. That was what the very Revolutionary War was about, was to get out of a debt-based monetary system. And until we do that, this is insane. You can't make sense of the statement that the guest made that we have to borrow money to pay off a borrowed debt. Using borrowed money fails to understand what is money itself, because the country and all the work that goes on in the country is the reason for the existence of money, and it's called a money supply for a reason. But
all right, on that comment, we have to say goodbye. Professor Zivni, thank you very much for being with us this hour. We appreciate your time.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Distinguished Professor of Finance at the Miller College of Business at Ball State University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up for a while. Get caught up on all that's going on, and we'll return with another hour and get an important history lesson.